history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that we need to hear. Sometimes it only takes asking the right questions and taking the time to listen, but we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained, often inspired by these members of our greatest generation. And this weekend, all across the country, Japanese American communities will be marking the 75th anniversary of Executive Order 9066 that paved the way for the internment of 120,000 Japanese Americans on the West Coast, and certainly brought angst and uncertainty and frustration to other Japanese Americans. And we're going to hear from a member of the famed 442nd Regimental Combat Team today who was not in an internment camp. And if you don't take the time to pay attention to this issue, maybe you don't even know that there were Japanese Americans who didn't end up in the camps. But that's the case for Sam Terasaki here in Denver, Colorado. And Sam, you must love this place because you were born here and you live here at age 92. Has it changed a little bit in those 92 years?
Oh, Colorado Boulevard had a gravel road. And I lived in North Cherry Creek area, which is probably the most sought-after area, neighborhood now, most expensive neighborhood in the city of Denver.
So Peyton Manning lives in your old house? Is that what you're saying?
Now, the road in front of our house was gravel. It was a strange neighborhood. One side of University Boulevard was the establishment of Denver, the Denver Country Club, and all the people who were prominent in the city.
Uh-huh.
On the east side of University Boulevard was made up of hardworking people that were in the working class, bricklayers, carpenters, plumbers.
Mm-hmm.
My dad was a merchant. He moved there on 4th and Clayton Street in 1922, I believe.
Not long before you were born. And did you have brothers and sisters?
Two brothers and three sisters, six kids altogether.
And where did you fit into that order?
The last.
You're the baby.
And I'm the last. All of them have passed on since.
I bet your big brothers must have toughened you up a little bit, though, huh?
Oh, they used to tease me a lot. But there was 10 years difference between my oldest brother.
Uh-huh.
12 years difference between the oldest sibling.
What do you remember about those young years growing up here in Denver as a boy? Did you have some ideas of what you're going to do when you grew up? Some hopes and dreams and ambitions?
No, not at that age. My older sister was born in Wyoming. Actually, I think she was the first Asian American born in the state of Wyoming.
Wow.
Soon after that, my dad moved to Denver because he was associated with a company out of Japan called the Ban Company, B-A-N.
Mm-hmm.
They had branches in Sheridan, Wyoming, where he managed a store there in Portland. They opened one up on Larimer Street in Denver, and he came down from Wyoming to Denver to manage that store.
Was there a sizable Japanese-American community here? Were you guys isolated? Did you ever feel any discrimination?
No, in that time, I think in the state of Colorado, there were less than 3,000 Americans of Japanese ancestries, and also the Issei, or the first generation, that mm-hmm. weren't allowed to citizenship.
Right.
Less than 3,000.
And you mentioned that, and some people don't understand all those terms. So the Issei was the generation before you. You're the Nisei.
That's right.
Born second, here in America.
Based on the numerical system, Ichini, Sanchi.
Right.
Nisei is second generation in this country.
Right.
Issei is the first generation. Sansei would be my son.
Right. And you must have been in high school when Imperial Japan attacked Pearl Harbor.
Yes, I was. I graduated in 42, and that happened in December of 41, graduated in June of 42.
So what do you remember about that? How did you find out? And
well, at that time, it was East Denver High School, probably considered the best high school of the five high schools in the city of Denver at that time.
A few more than that now, huh?
Quite a few, yeah. We had a student body of a little over 2,000. That's the 10th, 11th, and 12th grade. And on December 7th, for some reason, while they called an all-school assembly, they called I think, three or four of us into the principal's office without telling us why. And we sat in the principal's office. Turned out that one of the speakers, and this was post-December 7th, the featured speaker that day was Mrs. Gates, whose family ran the Charles Gates tire manufacturing business in Denver. They owned a winter home in Hawaii. And she was in Hawaii, I guess, during the December 7th attack.
Wow.
Turns out, I guess, his speech was some propaganda that actually some things that she felt were going on that proved later on to be false, like cutting arrows in the cane fields and sabotage by the Nisei and stuff like that.
Wow. But you didn't get to hear the speech?
No, they didn't want you to. I didn't find out about the speech until later on.
So what did they tell you when you went to the office?
Nothing. They just asked us to sit there.
So they didn't want any students of Japanese descent hearing what she was saying?
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm not sure whether that was the reason or whether they felt there'd be backlash with our presence there or not.
Uh-huh.
December 7th, I was out rabbit hunting with my brother, one of my brothers, and his friend, Joe Morishige, who was killed in the war, I think in Italy or France. We went rabbit hunting with our .22 rifles, and it was a weird thing. We actually went around the outskirts of what was a new air base called Laurie Field. It had moved here from Illinois, and relatively new. I think it moved here sometime in 1937 or something. We didn't know anything about the start of the war until we got home. But in hindsight, I imagine three guys with rifles in a trying to tell officials that we were hunting rabbits when we're circling around a military base.
A base on high alert because they just heard that Pearl Harbor was attacked.
I don't know whether they were on high alert or not.
Wow. I know we're going to hear some stories that are going to amaze us at how you survived in Europe, but it's somewhat surprising you survived that if you're a young Japanese-American yeah. with a gun by an Air Force base. Hey, so then you get home, and you hear it on the radio, or your folks tell you?
Yeah. And then I don't know how long later, whether it was a day or 2 days or a week, but the FBI came to our home, interviewed each one of us separately.
Wow.
I was 17 years old.
You're a 17-year-old kid getting grilled by the FBI?
Scared as hell. And, you know, you hear a lot about the FBI, and I guess one of the big radio shows at that time was Gangbusters. And,
oh, yeah. Yeah. Elliot Ness and all that. Yeah. What'd they ask you? What kind of stuff were they trying to get out of you?
Well, I don't remember. I think most of it just wanted to know if we were loyal and what we were up to.
And you had mentioned your father had done a lot of business with businessmen from Japan.
Yeah. So I'm sure that they didn't throw him into camp, but they did throw several, like the Buddhist priests, local Buddhist priests and stuff, were sent to a separate camp.
So December 7th happens, not long after the FBI comes to your home, interviews everybody, and I'm sure you're afraid of what's going to happen. But then a couple months later, the president issues this 9066, this executive order, basically saying that if you're a Japanese-American on the West Coast, you're an enemy alien, and you're out here in Colorado. Were you concerned that they were going to put you in a camp, put your whole family in a camp?
No, it never struck me. I really don't know why. Might have been because we didn't live in the Japanese community in Denver. We lived, I think there was only two families that lived in East Denver then. No, it didn't concern me at all, although I was aware of them being thrown into camp, yeah.
Did that make you angry to know that these people, just because of their last name or their appearance?
No, just wondered why. I wasn't really that political in those days. Now I'm a political junkie.
Uh-oh. I'm sure you have a lot to say about what's happening in our country right now.
That's what I turned off just now.
When did you start to realize that you might be involved in this war that America had now been drawn into?
Well, I didn't face any discrimination for the few months later that I was in high school until I graduated in June of 42. Although some of the fellow students just maybe were afraid to get too involved with me. All of my friends were of Caucasian descent. A lot of my closest friends were actually Jewish kids that went to the school. I don't remember any of them ever coming up and say, Sam, don't worry, we're with you, and stuff like that. But on the other hand, they never turned their backs on me either. So I was fortunate in that sense.
And how'd you end up in the Army?
Well, I was drafted. You know the story about being designated enemy alien.
Yeah.
Well, that's it. See, in 1942, I should have been drafted right away. I was 17, 18 then, 1A classification. It was in the spring of 42. They changed the classification from 1A to 4C.
Right.
I didn't fight it. I'm 4C. I'm 4C.
It didn't bother you that this country you're born in is calling you an enemy alien and unfit to serve?
No, I said to hell with them.
You just stay out of the way and keep your nose down.
I decided I was going to work a couple of years and go to university. Mm-hmm. If they wanted me, they have to come after me. I wasn't about to volunteer, mainly because I knew I had a hunch of where we would end up.
Really? What was that hunch?
That we couldn't join the Air Force, we couldn't join the Navy, couldn't join the Marines or the Merchant Marine. We were headed for the Army and the part of the Army that I didn't like. If I had had a chance to, actually, after I was inducted, I volunteered for the Air Force, but they wouldn't. So I volunteered for the Navy. I hate ships, but I volunteered just to stay out of being designated infantryman.
Right, because you knew what that meant.
Yeah.
But you're saying you saw that coming. You figured that you guys would be the expendable ones?
Well.
Or that they were going to need some bodies at some point?
You don't want to go in the infantry during a hot war.
No. What about your brothers? Did they end up in the service too?
No, my oldest brother was the big source of income for our family. Then my dad went bankrupt during the Great Depression in 1929. Mm-hmm. His customers were the Japanese American community in the states of Colorado and Wyoming and Nebraska. Farmers who were initially worked on a railroad, but when the Transcontinental Railroad was finished, they ended up starting their own little farms as sharecroppers. And so he would import Japanese goods, didn't sell any perishables, but mostly staples, clothing, canned goods, things like that, and rice, and shipped it out to the different communities in Wyoming and Nebraska. And so my wife's family knew my family from that.
Mm. So we were talking about how you ended up in the Army. So when you are declared enemy alien, you don't mind.
So I worked for a couple of years in my brother-in-law's drugstore. That's another story. He got a scholarship from one of the Denver high schools, Manuel High School, got a scholarship, went to Colorado University, earned his bachelor's degree in pharmacy, graduated at the top of his class. Soon after that, he first went to work for an independent pharmacy and later was able to buy another independent pharmacy. In the meantime, my oldest brother went to a college of pharmacy called the Capital College of Pharmacy. It was a crash course to get your license in pharmacy. Their most famous alumni at Capital College of Pharmacy was Hubert Humphrey.
Oh, how about that?
Who later turned out to be, as you know, our vice president. But after he graduated, he ran the drugstore while my brother-in-law went on to medical school. And it was the drugstore that supported him going into medical school. While he was there, the government offered commissions to med students, provided they would serve, I think, a couple of years in the service after they graduated. But they didn't offer it to my brother-in-law. Hmm. So when he graduated, he just set up his own private practice.
So you're working in the pharmacy?
Yeah, I went to work a couple of years there and then felt that I had earned enough money to start at Colorado University, passed the tests, and enrolled in the spring of 1944. Paid my rent, had a room all to myself for $15 a month, completely furnished. While I was waiting for the quarter to start, well, I got my reclassification from 4C to 1A.
And what did that feel
so
like?
So I was, well, I didn't object. Called in. I got my deposit on my room rent and everything then. Was inducted in May of 1944. But one of the things that they were so hard up for replacements for the 442nd and the 100th Infantry Battalion is that from the day I was inducted until I first heard my enemy shell coming over my head was less than 6 months.
Wow.
Yeah, that was May of 44. Went to Camp Shelby, Mississippi for basic training in June of 44. And they sent us home for 2-week furlough. While I was home, one of the cadre from Mississippi, who was a Colorado boy, came home and called me up, and I knew of him, but I didn't know him that well. And he says, "Sam, you better be sure and tell your folks hello, because as soon as you get back, you're going to be shipped overseas." That's first I heard of that. And it turned out that was the way it was. After my furlough was over, I went back to Mississippi, and they'd already had the mattress bag, fill it up. We were shipped out on a troop train to Camp Shanks, New York.
You shared with us how you were able to avoid the internment, your time here in Denver. You've got a couple of years of freedom that a lot of Japanese Americans didn't have.
No, they didn't.
But then you get to Camp Shelby, and you're around a whole lot of Japanese Americans who have been in the camps.
When I was inducted at Fort Logan in Colorado, there might have been a dozen in our group, I'm not sure. Half of them were people that grew up in the farm communities north of Denver, a couple of whom I knew. The other half came out of one of the relocation camps, Camp Amachi, which is in southeastern Colorado.
Right.
I made friends with one of the fellows that came out of Amachi. I didn't know him from Adam, and he came, actually, he lived in California before the evacuation. So we had a friendship until we both ended up in the 100th Battalion when we were shipped overseas. I was in A Company and he was in C Company. We survived France, and when we were shipped back to Italy, well, he was killed back in Italy.
What was his name?
Bob Suyoka. I have a picture of him, and I never have been able to locate any member of his family.
Really?
Yeah. Been back to, I visited Grenada, Amachi camp.
Yeah.
Once, tried to find out some information, but I'm sure he has some family somewhere in California.
If you did connect with him, is there something that you would want to tell him about him?
No, what a good-looking guy he was. But mainly to give him the picture of him.
And we're going to do our best to make that connection, but for now, it's time for our first break. 92-year-old Sam Tarasaki is our guest today. When we come back, he'll share his close calls from Italy with the 100th Infantry Battalion, part of the famed Gopher Broke Unit, the 442nd Regimental Combat Team in World War II. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking the 75th anniversary of Executive Order 9066 this weekend, with an American veteran of Japanese descent who avoided incarceration in the infamous internment camps that held more than 120,000 prisoners. Sam Tarasaki of Denver, Colorado, led a mortar squad in Company A of the 100th Infantry Battalion. By the time he got overseas, that was a part of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, the most decorated American unit of its size in all of World War II. I can tell this is not something that stirs a lot of surface visible emotions for you. I mean, you're describing this for me in a very matter-of-fact way. But well, I'm thinking about a young man who's going to go overseas knowing that guys who've gone before him have gotten killed and that you might get killed.
Yeah.
How'd you feel about that?
Well, you do what you're supposed to do. I wondered why it was me and not the guy next to me that got wounded or killed. I was fortunate that I got through the war without a scratch. In retrospect, I think being classified 4C may have saved my life, because I would have been drafted right away and would have been ended up in the 442nd very early on and shipped overseas when the regiment went overseas. As it was, by the time I joined as a replacement, I had missed one of the big battles, the rescue of the Lost Battalion, and right. the capture of these two French towns, Biefontaine and Bruyères.
And that's the signature achievement of the 442, or the one that gets the most publicity, because
yes, right.
there were more members of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team killed and wounded than there were mostly Caucasian soldiers from that Lost Battalion rescued.
Yeah. Some of the fellows, when I joined up, they had just pulled back from the front lines, and one of the fellows whose brother I had taken basic training with, we looked him up, and sure enough, he was in the medics, and you could see in his eyes the hell that he'd gone through, because I had seen him in Camp Shelby before they shipped out as a replacement themselves. He was in the group of replacements just before me.
So when you saw him over there, you saw a different look in his eye?
Oh, absolutely. You could see that. You could tell that he was through hell.
What was your first taste of combat and what this is really going to be like?
Well, at that time, it was after they'd pulled back from the front lines, and we were so depleted in manpower that they gave us easy duty in southern France. That was from November until the next spring in March of 45. Yeah, all the time our particular company were in the Maritime Alps, I guess is what they called it. It was right on the border of Italy and France.
Right.
And being in a weapons platoon, my job each night was to go up to the outpost on the border and look down into Italy and man a machine gun just in case the Germans came, tried to attack there. Although I was a mortarman by, what do they call it, MOS or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And then when dawn would break, well, then we'd get out of that machine gun nest and come back down the mountain to the backside, into the French side, because they knew that there was a machine gun nest there. In fact, the German artillery had a direct hit on it one day when we were out of the...
So the very position that you occupied the night before or the night after got hit
during
the day?
Was
in
daytime. Uh-huh. Generally, the Germans wouldn't shoot their artillery at night because it would reveal their position
right.
very precisely, where in the daytime they would shell us. And when we went up the next night, we saw the destruction. And it actually was a direct hit.
Wow.
We had a spare 30 caliber machine gun barrel there, and you hold it up and look through it, and you could see a dent on the inside where a shrapnel hit.
That's a pretty direct hit.
Pretty direct hit.
Does that get your attention a little bit?
Yeah, a little bit.
And to do that night after night, you know, in the dark, not knowing what's out there, not knowing if you're going to have to fire that weapon or not. Was that tense, nerve-wracking?
No, it wasn't. The only time I got tense is when the old-timers used to scare the hell out of us replacements, you know, because we had a whole string of outposts besides a machine gun nest. They had dugouts all along, I don't know how many, couple miles maybe,
mm-hmm.
just my company. And they would say, oh, just to scare the hell out of us, I guess. Oh, I heard something there. And actually, they didn't.
Uh-huh.
But they'd say the Tedeschi's are coming in.
They pulled it over on you a few
yeah.
times before you figured it out, huh?
And those guys would send out a patrol every so often, 5-man, 7-man patrol, just to see if the Germans were up to anything. In the meantime, from November until March, the replacements kept coming over, more and more replacements to fill the depleted ranks.
Right. There
yeah.
were so many casualties,
yeah,
there
yeah,
were a lot to replace.
That's right. Then when we were considered full strength, well, that's when we shipped back to Italy. Didn't know it at that time, but when we came home with the regimental colors and had the honor of marching for President Truman, at that time it was Secretary of War Stimson, I believe, that told us that we were a unique outfit in that we were not under the jurisdiction of any one army or any one general or anything. They all had to go through the War Department. General Clark had the 100th Battalion in Italy. He didn't want to give them up, but Truscott in France wanted them from the invasion of southern France and for the battle in Germany. Clark lost out. The regiment, including the 100th Battalion, was sent to France. That's when they got involved, not only in the invasion of southern France. Some of the units flew into southern France on gliders.
Yeah.
Where they happened to end up rescuing the remnants of the regiment that was encircled. They were getting ready for the last offensive against the Germans, so Clark wanted the regiment back in Italy. So that's why we went from Italy to France and back to Italy, all the time in combat.
And I want to hear about what you experienced in Italy, but you just gave us an overview of the things that happened before you got there. And by the time you got there, this moniker, Go for Broke, I'm sure was well established. Is that something that you heard when you joined the unit?
Heard it more on the crap table than...
Well, that's where it originated, right?
That absolutely is a Hawaiian slang for all or nothing. And the guys would be rolling dice on the army blanket and say, okay, and he's down to his last chips. I'll go for broke. Yeah.
What did that mean to you? I mean, if you have to explain that to someone who's never even heard that term, and they say, well, why was 442 known as the Go for Broke unit?
Well, just explain to them. That's a Hawaiian term for...
Yeah.
All or nothing.
Well, and what did all or nothing mean for you and those guys in uniform?
That never entered my mind.
All right. So the way you're describing it, your first 4 or 5 months over there were fairly uneventful.
Absolutely. While we were exposed and some guys were wounded or killed, very few. You could count them on less than 10 fingers, although we were shelled just once in a while. We got our supplies, rations and things by mule train. Our battalion headquarters within a resort city in the Riviera, a place called Mentone, which was east of the big city of Nice. Well, that's where we went for rest and recuperation. And I remember getting my first break after going overseas and joining the outfit. It took us almost all day to get down to the battalion headquarters, and I was a little grimy. I don't think I'd had a bath or a shower for over, say, 5 weeks. So it's pretty ripe. But in the rest center, we had white tablecloths and silverware and didn't have to eat key rations. They had boxing matches there, a regimental boxing team. Got a haircut. We'd get a pass from the headquarters in Mentone to a little town named Beaujolais. It was right across the road from the Principality of Monaco. Which is off limits because they weren't involved in the war.
Well, it just sounds like one big adventure.
Yeah, it was a big adventure. I think the thing I remember most is when I came down from the mountains, checked in at the desk at the hotel where the rest center was, I saluted the captain. Actually, he was a dentist, Captain Komitani from Hawaii in the original 100th Battalion, and at that time was designated as a morale officer for the regiment. And I saluted him and told him my name. And he said, where are you from? And I said, Denver, Colorado. And he said, really? He says, I took your sister out on dates. Turns out that he had gone to Denver University. And that's where my older sister had gone.
What a small world.
Small world.
That's crazy.
That's something you won't forget. But anyway, the other thing is, when my rest was over, well, we'd take all day to hike back to the top of the mountain. The number of the old-timers had just come back from New York. The old-timers in the 100th Battalion then were mostly from Hawaii, so they didn't get to go to Hawaii on rotation, but they did get to go back to the mainland. It just so happened that Captain Fukuda, who later became battalion commander, was in our group that were going back up the mountain to the outpost. As I said, it took all day to climb up there. So during one of our rest stops, and I don't know why he brought it up, except that I guess he was an educator in Hawaii before he was drafted. And he said, you know, I just came back from New York on rotation. He scolded some of the guys for practicing racial discrimination on their own, that you're all in the same boat. I don't know whether they realized it, but they looked down upon the African Americans at that time. I think there were some problems with the California Nisei and the Mexican laborers. Didn't treat them quite like they should have. So he just kind of lectured to us during one of our rests, climbing up back up to the outpost, which I thought was, in hindsight, is probably what you'd expect from a guy like Fukuda.
It was eye-opening for you, it sounds like.
Yeah, it was.
And why do I have the feeling that there were some eye-opening moments for you when you got to Italy?
Well, when we got to Italy, they gave us all new rifles and mortars and stuff. We did a little practicing. I guess one of the highlights was the fact that General Clark came up in a jeep to address the 100th Battalion, and knowing that we were going to go into battle, and the Battle of the Gothic Line, wished us well and welcomed us back to Italy and so forth. It was day after or so that night, I'm not sure which, and we pushed off and were hauled in the big open bed trucks up to the front lines and then walked the rest of the way up the hill in the dark until we were committed to battle in the morning of April 5th.
Were you prepared for what you were going to experience?
No, because I hadn't experienced anything like that where you're throwing grenades at each other. We set up our mortar in a foxhole that had been dug by American forces that were there ahead of us. My best Army buddy, who was from originally from Oxnard, California, who settled in Atlanta, Georgia, Mike Doy, he and I were in the mortar squad that I was in charge of, set up our mortar, and while up above us, the guys in the rifle platoons were fighting.
So you're seeing things and hearing things and probably smelling things and experiencing things that you've never experienced before.
Well, the foxhole was dug in a position where there was a huge rock on our left side, up against a huge rock. A rifle grenade or potato masher, I think it was a rifle grenade, came down and luckily hit on the opposite side of that rock.
So bang. Only a few feet from you, maybe 10 feet or something?
No, inches.
But the rock was in between you and the impact.
Yeah.
So if the rock's not there,
we're gone. We're gone. One of the, I don't know whether he was an officer or not, but he was in the outfit that was there before we replaced them, came down the trail. It was a narrow, very narrow trail. He's kind of chuckling. I think he was happy that he's going to go to the rear echelon. He says, those guys are up there throwing grenades at each other. Well, that's what happened. In fact, the one Medal of Honor that was bestowed during the war was Spud Munimori, who was in our company, A Company. In fact, I'd just talked to him an hour before when the rifle platoon was cutting through our line to get ahead of us, and I just happened to see him, and I said, okay, well, take it easy, Spud. And it was still dark, and that was the last I saw him. He was killed, saving the life of two of his squad members by jumping on the grenade before it exploded. Took his own life, saved their lives.
I can tell in your eyes and in your voice that he's someone you admire and respect.
Absolutely. And it's something that I never talked about for maybe 50 years after the fact, I guess. I don't know how many years it was, but I just couldn't talk about it without crying. It was my family. We had a dinner at home, and I don't know how the subject came up, but I started crying. I guess somebody wanted to know about the war, and I had to excuse myself. And I find that the more you talk about it, the easier it is to do it without getting so emotional. But some things that, horrible things that, you know, we had, I think, five guys in our company alone that had their foot blown off that morning of the 5th of April.
Your first day in combat.
Yeah, and they had their foot blown off. And the litter bearers, like I say, the trail up to the front lines was so narrow that they had to come by our gun emplacement. And
so you're seeing them come by one after one after the other.
Yeah.
And wondering when you're going to be.
Well, I remember two in particular. One, I didn't know him, but he was a rifleman, I'm sure, had stepped on a mine, and the litter bearers were taking him back to the first aid station, and he kept saying, itai, itai, which in Japanese means it hurts, it hurts. What was left of his foot, they put back on the litter because it had fallen off the side. It was hanging there by the skin. Another fellow that I remember was Lieutenant Novak, who was a platoon leader, and had his foot blown off. Oh, he was, even though they, I know they, medics must have given him a shot of morphine. He was still in pain. You could hear him moaning all the way down the mountain as they carried him down to the aid station. Novak eventually became an MD, lost his foot, of course. And during one of our reunions, here's this rabbi that showed up at one of our reunions, and it turns out he was Lieutenant Novak's son, and he wanted to know if there were any guys around at the reunion that knew his dad. And there were a couple.
And there were a couple non-Japanese American members of these units. And some people don't realize that. They hear 100th Battalion or 442, and they assume every single member was Japanese American. How did you guys interact with those who weren't Japanese American?
Well, it was easy for me because I grew up in a all-Caucasian community, very few Japanese. Actually, it was kind of a cultural thing for me. For instance, I grew up with eating half the time Japanese meals, half the time American meals, meat and potatoes. Mm-hmm. But when we were in basic training and when we were overseas, we ate as much rice as we could get our hands on. Trade our chocolate candy and cigarettes for rice when we were in Italy. Came home and always wanted rice. And my mother told my wife, my future wife, she says, I thought Sam was in the wrong army. He wanted rice all the time.
She thought you were wearing the rising sun, huh? No, his uniform was American. His flag was red, white, and blue, and his blood was every bit as red as any other American serviceman. We're not done just yet with 92-year-old Sam Terasaki. When we come back, we'll learn how a man once classified as an enemy alien ended up as a guest of honor outside the White House. Then 6 decades later, in the halls of Congress, Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. You know, if you're from Denver, Colorado, our guest today, Sam Terasaki, may have filled a prescription for you once upon a time. But first, he had to survive World War II as a 20-year-old mortar man in Italy with his fellow Nisei soldiers of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. You described for us April 5th, 45, your first day in combat. And people know that the war in Europe lasted another month beyond that. After experiencing that, seeing guys coming by with legs blown off, knowing that grenade landed so close that if the rock's not there, you're not there. How did you sleep that night? How did you cope with that on a daily basis moving forward?
I don't know. Those things you don't, at least I don't remember. I know we moved forward. Had to crawl through a minefield that the scouts had marked where the mines were, the same minefield that blew these guys' ankles off. Marked it with toilet paper, which we always carried. Take a sheet of toilet paper and put a little clod of dirt on it, and you knew it was safe to step there.
Well, that was my question. Did you know it was safe, or you just knew some weren't safe? It doesn't mean there aren't necessarily more out there that nobody found yet,
there
right?
There were more out there, but it just scared as hell and went ahead step by step, hoping that you didn't step on a mine that wasn't marked. We got through there and kept pushing the Germans back town to town from where we initially attacked to these little coastal towns, Massa, Carrara, where the famous marble quarry is, La Spezia, where the Italians had a naval base, Genoa.
And you're leading a mortar squad that entire time?
Yeah, carrying a mortar. Mm-hmm.
When you're firing that mortar, how frequent are those rounds, or what is that process like when you're in a position where...
Well, every time we would stop in a position, we'd set up our mortar and just wait for orders from the front, from the guys ahead of us.
You had a forward observer who's given you coordinates for a target?
Exactly, exactly. I know one time we set up our mortar in the marble quarry in Carrara, shooting straight, almost straight up over the marble mountain to positions that they thought they were in. I don't remember exact location was, but another time we set up our mortar and they called for some rounds, so we sent a couple of rounds over the mountain. And, you know, being a mortar man, you don't know whether...
You never see what you're hitting.
That's right. The only thing on that particular time when we moved forward, we saw a bunch of bloody bandages and stuff like that. But we don't know whether...
You don't know if it's from you or...
No.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if you're firing a mortar, they start to figure out where those shells are coming from, right? And then you're probably taking some incoming also?
Oh, yeah. That was the thing that they worried the most. The artillery, you could hear it coming. Mortar rounds, you didn't hear it until it was just before it exploded. You hear a squish, bang. Whereas a German 88, you'd hear, and then it would explode.
So how close did German mortar rounds come to your position?
We were leaving a fort in North Italy, spent the night in the fort, old, old fort, ancient fort that had a moat around it, bars on the windows. When we left there, we were shelled that night, but the artillery shells hit the wall, so all it did is kind of knock the breath out of us, but it didn't penetrate the walls because they were so thick. But when we pushed out of there, we followed this stone wall that bordered the roadside. Just then, a mortar attack happened. Turns out that one of our jeeps was just coming back, and I think he must have been a forward observer or something from ahead of us. For some reason, he stopped there. There was a wall in between us and where the jeep was and where we were resting, and mortar shells came down. Next thing you know, the guy's laying on the ground. One of our guys is laying on the ground on the road, hollering, "Medics, medics." So I think it was Mike and myself jumped over the wall and went over there and put a bandage on his calf. He was had a bad slash, a shrapnel slash on his calf. We all carried this first aid thing. It's a pad where you put it on there and then tie it as tight as you can. Compress is what it was. That's closest I came to a mortar attack, I think. On the 5th of April, I don't think we were exposed to as many mortar attacks as we were to artillery and to grenades, rifle grenades.
And you told us about the one, the grenade that landed on the other side of the rock.
Yeah.
Were there other situations that you look back on now and say, hey, that was pretty close?
Oh, I guess in one town, as we pushed forward in Italy, in one town, we were getting shelled. Fortunately, one of the shells didn't hit us, but hit the house down the road from us. I think it was some B Company guys got killed then. I jumped in a haystack. The Italian farmhouses had their animals on the first floor and their living quarters on the second floor. This is on the first floor. Jumped in the haystack, not realizing the place was full of fleas. I fought the fleas for the next 2 months.
Regretted that decision?
Well, I itched a lot, scratched a lot.
I guess it would be worth it if being in the haystack saved your life.
That's right. And it just so happened that the guy that was driving the truck full of artillery shells or whatever it was parked the car and ran into the house. And here's this truck loaded with ammunition. And, of course, the Germans didn't hit it. Been one hell of an explosion. I don't know what the name of the town. You know, as a infantryman or mortarman, you don't get the latest news. In fact, some of the old-timers knew that the war was going to end then. We never knew that.
When did you figure it out, and what did it mean to you?
Didn't believe it. We were in a town in northern Italy after we had captured a number of Germans and had them on the run. I was in a town, spent a miserable night in this town square, rained all night, covered myself with my shelter half and woke up in the morning and all kinds of native Italians running around said the war is over. I didn't believe them, but it was shortly after that an observation plane flew over and dumped the bundles of the Stars and Stripes and said the war is over. That's when I knew.
How big of a relief was that?
Oh, you don't. I remember none of the guys jump up and down or anything. It just kind of took it as a matter of fact. We were happy that it was over, and it was a day or two later we had a memorial service at an abandoned warehouse. Our chaplain delivered a sermon and read the names of all the guys in the 100th from the first one that was killed down in Salerno. Very sad. Couldn't help from crying.
I believe it. And I'm sure, even though, as you're telling it, there was only about a month that you spent in real intense combat, that had to be the longest month of your life, right?
Yeah, I think so.
And sure, there had to be days in there where you thought your name could have been one of those in the chaplain's reading.
Well, maybe wondered why I'd survived and the others didn't.
Did you have days where you thought that was going to be it? Did you?
Oh, sure, yeah. Pray to God. Pray to God when we're under artillery fire that the next one wouldn't come over and hit us.
It's got to be a pretty helpless feeling.
It is. What do? Put your hands over your head and hug the ground as much as you can and hope that you don't get hit. I know I recited the Lord's Prayer all the time.
I'm just imagining being in those shoes and how lonely and scary and just difficult that must have been.
It was. It was scary. When your legs start shaking, you can't stop it from shaking. That's when I knew I was scared.
And you mentioned that memorial service while you're still there in Italy, and the war has just ended, and they're reading off name after Japanese surname. Some of those guys are probably guys you knew?
Yeah.
And you told them, you're crying.
Yeah.
How should we today remember those guys whose names you heard read that day?
Well, I don't know. I just live a good life. Pay them back by living a good life and being tolerant. You know, when I joined the outfit, from the old-timers, I heard maybe three or four names of guys that they all looked up to. One of them, who was our chaplain, Israel Yost, Pennsylvania Dutch chaplain that never knew what an American of Japanese ancestry was. In fact, he was given the option of not being in the 100th Battalion if he didn't want to be. I told him that this is made up of all Japanese Americans, and you don't have to be part of it if you don't want to. And he says, no, it makes no difference to him. He wanted to be a combat chaplain, and that's what he did. So he was one of the guys that all of the old-timers used to talk about, because he wasn't a chaplain that stayed in the back. He was a chaplain right up there with the medics, retrieving bodies, giving the last rites, things like that. Two more. Fukuda ended up as battalion commander in the end. Didn't have to lead the Fukuda task force, which was actually just, I think, one or two jeeps going from the last place in northern Italy that we went to. They drove all the way up to the Swiss border. He very well could have been shot by a sniper or something. A Korean-American who was our battalion intelligence officer. They were aware of the friction between Koreans and Japan.
Yeah.
So they gave him also the option. Of course, he says, I grew up in Los Angeles. My father had a grocery store there. I have a lot of Japanese-American friends. That makes no difference to me. He gained a lot of respect. When the 100th Battalion was Anzio, they needed information. He crawled on his belly and took two non-coms with him. He crawled on his belly all night and grabbed a couple of German prisoners and made them crawl all the way back, and they got information.
Sounds like those guys set a pretty powerful example.
He did.
Were you excited to come home?
Oh, absolutely. Even though it was a slow ship, I went over on the Queen Mary, which was a fast ship.
Yeah.
Came home on a victory ship, which was a slow ship. But we were bringing home the regimental colors in the summertime, sleep on the deck at night, ice cream every night.
Hey, hey.
Movies. Well, we hit New York Harbor because it was a big celebration that the city of New York and the Army put on for us, welcoming the regiment home. Big to-do in New York Harbor, and then preparing to march in Washington, D.C.
What was that like?
I think we drilled for almost 2 weeks at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, across the Potomac from D.C., got new uniforms and everything. And then they went over to D.C. and it was a rainy day, but the story goes that asked Truman, he said, in light of the weather, you want to cancel, And he says, no. He supposedly said, what these boys been through, what's a little rain? So He came out of the White House to the Ellipse, which is a oval-shaped area across from the White House, and we passed in review, and he had a rain trench coat on and pinned the presidential unit citation on our regimental colors and welcomed us home.
quite the contrast from being told you're 4C.
Well, it is. Thinking back makes you wonder. Roosevelt, I don't think he really knew the character of the Americans of Japanese ancestry that lived in this country. He was born and raised in New York, and I don't think there are very many Japanese back there.
I've noticed a few times now that every time you refer to it, you use the verbiage, Americans of Japanese ancestry. You don't want a hyphen in there anywhere.
No.
Why is that?
I've been approached by a number of people, and because of my facial features and stuff, they say, are you Japanese? I know what they mean.
Right.
But I make it a point to say, no, I'm an American. Not to embarrass them, but what they have to realize is that America is made up of all different ethnic groups. And I'm an American, I just happen to be an American of Japanese ancestry.
And when you are in front of the White House with the President of the United States pinning the highest honor he can give to a unit on your unit colors, I guess you guys proved how American you were.
Never occurred to me.
And you said something to me. You'd be eligible for a Bronze Star for having been a combat soldier in Europe. You'd be eligible for a medal from the French government for helping to liberate that country. And you have not taken advantage of those opportunities. And you told me that the things that mean the most to you are that PUC, that Presidential Unit Citation, and your Combat Infantry Badge. Why? Why do those two decorations give you pride?
I've seen too many guys who deserve more than they got. One of the things that when I went over and we're in our off times, we'd talk about it, and you know, the guys would say, well, you know, so-and-so should have gotten a Medal of Honor. He didn't. He got a Distinguished Service Cross instead. And it said, all in how you write it up. And apparently, our higher-ups didn't know how to exactly write up a citation. That was part of it, and probably a lesser part than the fact that they weren't about to give a Congressional Medal of Honor to. There was even controversy about giving a Congressional Medal of Honor to Munimori.
Well, and the thing that backs that up is what President Clinton did in the 90s,
yeah,
which was upgrade some of those Distinguished Service Crosses to Medals of Honor for guys like your friend
that's
Joe Sakato
right
here in Denver.
So I told my son and my family, they, why didn't you apply for those? Medals don't mean that much to me.
I do want to ask you about one other medal, though, because this was in the last decade here. 60 years after the war, they say the Congressional Gold Medal goes to all Nisei veterans.
And my son, I wasn't even going to go to that, but my family insisted I go, and they said, well, you need an escort. I said, I could do it myself. My son said, oh, I'd like to go anyway. So we went, and we were there for the ceremony.
What did that mean to you, that the Congress of the United States is singling you out as saying you did something worth celebrating?
It meant a lot to me that we were getting the recognition that we deserved. On the other hand, we're sitting back there several rows back, and the politicians are sitting in front of us. And I told my son, I said, where were they when we needed them? But it was good because Danny Noe gave a nice speech.
I was going to say, he's the one politician you couldn't blame because he's a
right.
Medal of Honor winner.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to forget to say something important. Thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us this story from your perspective. When it comes to the Americans of Japanese ancestry who served our country during World War II, what gives you the most pride, and what do you think is the biggest thing that the rest of us who weren't around then need to know and remember?
I'm glad I served. My feeling is it opened the doors for the rest of our children. They're doing things that we wouldn't even think of doing, no. So life is easier, even though I know that they face discrimination once in a while. So I think we opened a lot of doors. That was because the Nisei soldiers did a good job. The guys in the MIS did a good job. The other thing is I want to make sure that this story is told over and over again, something like the Jewish Holocaust. If you don't talk about it, they're going to forget.
And it could happen again.
It could happen again. The fact that I let you interview me and the fact that I've been interviewed before, and it's because I want the rest of the America to know what we did during the war, that we're Americans just like anyone else that was born here, even though we look different.
Amen. And when you say you opened a lot of doors, tell me if I'm wrong when I say this. Aren't some of the other doors that you opened the gates to those internment camps? Even though you never had to spend time in them, what you guys did overseas made it impossible for the government to ignore and really force their hand in releasing those people who had been wrongly imprisoned.
Yeah.
And you told us about some of your close calls there overseas. If those go a little differently, you don't come back, you don't go to pharmacy school and become a pharmacist, you don't meet your wife, your son's never born. You ever think about that?
I don't know. Maybe I did. I don't know. I guess going to the monument and looking at that, so my name could be on the front end of that monument. But I'm lucky. Even now, in peacetime, I'm blessed. 92 years old and still able to cook for myself, still able to drive.
What would you say you're most thankful for, Sam?
That I have a good family. Thankful that I'm blessed the way I am.
And we are blessed to know you. Sam Tarasaki, 92 years old. I hope you took his words to heart today, as I'm going to try to. Find photos of Sam at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.